So good evening. Welcome. Tonight we have only a few pages left and we finish this sixth chapter, Reality and the Cosmic Illusion. A rather long chapter. Sri Aurobindo has in the last few pages transited from a discussion of the question of cosmic reality back to the question of what is the absolute, beyond form, beyond formlessness, the finite, yet the finite. So we resume with this question as we pursue to the end of the chapter. The absolute is in itself, indefinable by reason, ineffable to the speech. It has to be approached through experience. So while Sri Aurobindo has been promulgating his philosophy of the life divine, he has given some place to the power of reason to fashion in language apprehensible to the mind what is a picture of reality and the universe that manifests and the individual's place within it. And yet ultimately, when we speak about the highest realities, when we speak about the absolute beyond all manifestation, reason falls back unattaining in the language of the Taittiriya Upanishad. It is impossible to speak it. The word may convey something. It may, in fact, act as a magnet to draw us to that. The word is evocative, but it is not exhaustive. It does not tell the whole of what that mystery is, so it is ineffable. So ultimately, if we can get access to this absolute, it is through experience that we achieve it. So in a sense, it is the yogin's experience which outranks the philosopher's rationale. It is a practical psychology, an inward route by which our psyche penetrates, becomes one with that absolute. That gives us the only truly satisfying answer. He continues, it, the absolute, can be approached through an absolute negation of existence, as if it were itself a supreme non-existence, a mysterious infinite nihil. It can be approached through an absolute affirmation of all the fundamentals of our own existence, through an absolute of light and knowledge, through an absolute of love or beauty, through an absolute of force, through an absolute of peace or silence. This justifies and stands at the basis of all these various paths of ascent, jnana yoga, bhakti yoga, karma yoga. It can be approached, he says, through an inexpressible absolute of being or of consciousness or of power of being or of delight of being or through a supreme experience in which these things become inexpressibly one. For we can enter into such an ineffable state and plunged into it as if into a luminous abyss of existence, we can reach a superconscience which may be described as the gate of the absolute. So here he describes the nature of Satchit-Ananda, existence, consciousness, and bliss, approachable through a gate of superconscience, which we can take to be an allusion to the supramental. It is supposed that it is only through a negation of individual and cosmos, that we can enter into the absolute. But in fact, the individual need only deny his own small, separate ego existence. He can approach the absolute through a sublimation of his spiritual individuality, taking up the cosmos into himself and transcending it. Or he may negate himself altogether, but even so, it is still the individual who, by self-exceeding, enters into the absolute. So it is not the nature of individuality which separates us from the absolute or from that great emergence back into being, but the sense of separativity, the fiction of the distance between us and that. There is no distance. There is no distinction. There is a differentiation, yes, but no division, no gulf. So we can annihilate that separation and be one with that. And he says that we can sublimate our spiritual individuality, in other words, that thing in us which is spiritual in essence, and gathering the cosmos into ourselves, rise and transcend it. Or we can, if we wish, abolish the sense of individuality. But even so, it's still the individual who is determining the plunge back into that absolute, the drop saying, I want to go into the ocean. He continues, he may enter also by a sublimation of his being into a supreme existence or super existence, by a sublimation of his consciousness into a supreme consciousness or superconscience, by a sublimation of his and all delight of being into a super delight or supreme ecstasy. So any of these triune gates can lead to that, and again he's touching upon the various chords of Satchit-Ananda here. And incidentally, this is an itinerary of his own yogic experiences over the years. These are not philosophically determined steps in reasoning out this must follow that, etc., etc. These are things he's actually done within his own consciousness. He can make the approach through an ascension in which he enters into cosmic consciousness, assumes it into himself, and raises himself and it into a state of being in which oneness and multiplicity are in perfect harmony and unison in the supreme status of manifestation, where all are in each, and each in all, and all in the one without any determining individuation. For the dynamic identity and mutuality have become complete. On the path of affirmation, it is this status of the manifestation that is nearest to the absolute. And this is often figured in the peacock's fan. Peacock being the bird of spiritual victory, and the all in each, and the all in the all, and the each in all. All is a manifestation of the one. This paradox of an absolute, which can be realized through an absolute negation and through an absolute affirmation, in many ways can only be accounted for to the reason if it is a supreme existence, which is so far above our notion and experience of existence that it can correspond to our negation of it, to our notion and experience of non-existence. But also, since all that exists is that, whatever its degree of manifestation, it is itself the supreme of all things, and can be approached through supreme affirmations as through supreme negations. The Absolute is the ineffable X overtopping and underlying an immanent and essential in all that we can call existence or non-existence. Either verbal attempt to assimilate the Absolute leads you back to that, but does not exhaust that. So now we get back to the ground of his argument. It is our first premise that the Absolute is the supreme reality. But the issue is whether all else that we experience is real or unreal. A distinction is sometimes made between being and existence. And we might pause there. And I think we understand that being is a reference to what is essential, the beingness of things, what underlies all things. And existence, from the word exist, means to stand out from. So in the view of some philosophers, existence would be a standing out of something that is apprehendable and which is nameable as existence, but there is an unnameable something underlying it from which it stands out. So let's start again. A distinction is sometimes made between being and existence, and it is supposed that being is real, but existence, or what manifests as such, is unreal. And remember, manifest means to become clear. So always there, but suddenly standing to the view. But this can stand only if there is a rigid distinction, a cut and separation between the uncreated eternal and created existences. The uncreated being can then be taken as alone real. This conclusion does not follow if what exists is form of being and substance of being. It would be unreal only if it were a form of non-being, a sat, created out of the void, shunya. And there are schools of Advaita and schools of Buddhism that would have it be so. Sri Aurobindo continues, the states of existence through which we approach and enter into the Absolute must have their truth, for the untrue and unreal cannot lead into the real. But also what issues from the Absolute, what the Eternal supports and informs and manifests in itself, must have a reality. So he is referred here to the gate alluded to above, but also repeated a long-held position that the world cannot be unreal, because if it comes in any sense from what is real, then it must share in that reality. It cannot be elusive. It cannot be a complete fiction. It cannot be only partially real. If it comes from the real, then it must be real. There is the unmanifest, and there is the manifestation. But a manifestation of the real must itself be real. There is the timeless, and there is the process of things in time, but nothing can appear in time unless it has a basis in the timeless reality. If myself and spirit are real, my thoughts, feelings, powers of all kinds, which are its expressions, cannot be unreal. My body, which is the form it puts out in itself, in which at the same time it inhabits, cannot be a nothing or a mere unsubstantial shadow. The only reconciling explanation is that timeless eternity and time eternity are two aspects of the eternal and absolute, and both are real, but in a different order of reality. What is unmanifest in the timeless manifests itself in time. Each thing that exists is real in its own degree of the manifestation and is so seen by the consciousness of the infinite. In a way, each finite is aspected by the infinite. Time is a measuring out of the timeless. Drawn from the timeless, it does not end. It is itself the timeless, but portrayed in time. There is no division and no gulf between what occurs in eternal timelessness and what occurs in the eternity of time. They are consanguineous in an ultimate sense. To return to his argument, all manifestation depends upon being, but also upon consciousness and its power or degree. For as is the status of consciousness, so will be the status of being. So he's just covered the nature of being of the Absolute, Sat. Now we turn to the nature of consciousness of the Absolute, Chit. Even the inconscient is a status and power of involved consciousness in which being is plunged into another and opposite state of non-manifestation resembling non-existence, so that out of it all in the material universe may be manifested. So too the superconscient is consciousness taken up into an absolute of being. So the inconscience is a storehouse filled with darkened potential, which must stand out in an eventual universal manifestation, and the superconscient is that which leans back into the absoluteness of being. He continues, for there is a superconscient status in which consciousness seems to be luminously involved in being and as if unaware of itself. In other words, it has not become an object of its own consciousness. This is one of the poises of the supramental, which we read about many, many chapters ago. All consciousness of being, all knowledge, self-vision, force of being, seem to emerge from that involved state or to appear in it. This emergence, in our view of it, may appear to be an emergence into a lesser reality, but in fact, both the superconscience and the consciousness are and regard the same real. So again, no gulf, no diminution of the real into some poise of supposed unreality, but always the positing of a reality into terms of consciousness. There is also a status of the Supreme in which no distinction can be made between being and consciousness, for they are too much one there to be thus differentiated. But this supreme status of being is also a supreme status of the power of being, and therefore of the power of consciousness. For the force of being and the force of its consciousness are one there and cannot be separated. It is this unification of eternal being with the eternal consciousness force that is the status of the Supreme Ishvara, and its force of being is the dynamis of the Absolute. This status is not a negation of cosmos. It carries in itself the essence and power of all cosmic existence. So he's proceeded from Sat to the nature of Chit, but now brought in the other aspect of Chit, which is Shakti, because because chit is never devoid of shakti. Consciousness is never devoid of power. Consciousness always contains power within it. And in this supreme status of being, we find the source of that being which rules the cosmos. This is the poise of Ishvara, that person who has conscious force dynamizes the absolute as the universe. All of cosmic being inheres in this consciousness and power of being, which is the Ishvara, the Supreme Lord. So this implies that the absolute is a category from which Ishvara emerges. He continues, but still, unreality is a fact of cosmic existence. And if all is the Brahman, the reality, we have to account for this element of unreality in the real. In other words, he must account for the experience and the perception of error, limitation, delusion. Because if there is only the absolute and there is only the real, then how do we get to such particular divergence from that truth? Why do we seem to land in that which does not know, in that which cannot fully express itself? How does the supremely powerful become weak? How does the supremely delightful become insentient or suffer, etc.? So we have to examine that. So let's start again. But still, unreality is a fact of cosmic existence, and if all is the Brahman, the reality, we have to account for this element of unreality in the real. If the unreal is not a fact of being, it must be an act or a formation of consciousness. And is there not then a status or degree of consciousness in which its acts and formations are wholly or partly unreal? If this unreality cannot be attributed to an original cosmic illusion, to Maya, there is still in the universe itself a power of illusion of ignorance. It is in the power of the mind to conceive things that are not real. It is in its power even to create things that are not real or not wholly real. Its very view of itself and universe is a construction that is not wholly real or wholly unreal. Where does this element of unreality begin and where does it stop? And what is its cause and what ensues on the removal of both the cause and the consequence? He's sort of equating here mind and ignorance. Even if all cosmic existence is not in itself unreal, cannot that description be applied to the world of ignorance in which we live, this world of constant change and birth and death and frustration and suffering? And does not the removal of the ignorance abolish for us the reality of the world which it creates, or is not a departure out of it the natural and only issue? Seems compelling. This would be valid if our ignorance were a pure ignorance, without any element of truth or knowledge in it. But, in fact, our consciousness is a mixture of the true and the false. Its acts and creations are not a pure invention, a baseless structure. The structure it builds, its form of things or form of the universe, is not a mixture of reality and the unreal, so much as a half-comprehension, a half-expression of the real. And since all consciousness is force and therefore potentially creative, our ignorance has the result of wrong creation, wrong manifestation, wrong action, or misconceived and misdirected energy of the being. Our world existence is manifestation, but our ignorance is the agent of a partial, limited, and ignorant manifestation, in part an expression, but in part also a disguise of the original being, consciousness, and delight of existence. So, always here is the original Satchit-Anand, but it is disguised. And the consciousness that we have, a mental aperture through which that reality is transferred into manifestation, is not the full ignorance, but it is also not a full ignorance. Not the full knowledge, I mean to say, but not also a full ignorance. If this state of things is permanent and unalterable, if our world must always move in this circle, if some ignorance is the cause of all things and all action here, and not a condition and circumstance, then indeed the cessation of individual ignorance could only come by an escape of the individual from world being, and a cessation of the cosmic ignorance would be the destruction of world being. But if this world has at its root an evolutionary principle, if our ignorance is a half-knowledge evolving towards knowledge, another account and another issue and spiritual result of our existence in material nature, a greater manifestation here becomes possible. A farther distinction has to be made in our conceptions of unreality, so as to avoid a possible confusion in our dealings with this problem of the ignorance. Our mind, or a part of it, has a pragmatic standard of reality. It insists on a standard of fact, of actuality. All that is fact of existence is to it real, but for it, this factuality or reality of the actual is limited to the phenomena of this terrestrial existence in the material universe. But terrestrial or material existence is only a part manifestation. It is a system of actualized possibilities of the being, which does not exclude all other possibilities not yet actualized or not actualized here. So, our factualities are based on the existence of the universe. It precedes our view. We already have that. It influences our perception. In a manifestation in time, new realities can emerge. Truths of being not yet realized can put forth their possibilities and become actual in the physical and terrestrial experience. Other truths of being there may be that are superphysical and belong to another domain of manifestation, not realized here, but still real. Even what is nowhere actual in any universe may be a truth of being, a potential of being, and cannot, because it is not yet expressed in form of existence, be taxed as unreal. So they may be waiting their time, these potentialities. What is not present in the here and now does not mean it will not be present in the future as evolution proceeds. But our mind, or this part of it, still insists on its pragmatic habit or conception of the real, which admits only the factual and actual as true, and is prone to regard all else as unreal. There is then, for this mind, an unreality which is of a purely pragmatic nature. It consists in the formulation of things which are not necessarily unreal in themselves, but are not realized or perhaps cannot be realized by ourselves or in present circumstances or in our actual world of being. This is not a true unreality. It is not an unreal, but an unrealized. Not an unreal of being, but only an unreal of present or known fact. In other words, the pragmatic seizes upon only the immediately apprehendable, and if it is not present, then it does not exist and cannot be real. That does not constitute unreality. There is again an unreality which is conceptual and perceptive and is caused by an erroneous conception and perception of the real. This too is not or need not be an unreality of being. It is only a false construction of consciousness due to limitation by ignorance. These and other secondary movements of our ignorance are not the heart of the problem, for that turns upon a more general affliction of our consciousness and the world consciousness here. It is the problem of the cosmic ignorance. So here we go. What is the nature of the ignorance? How is this constriction of consciousness, which we have seen him explain in earlier chapters, responsible for the diminished universe that we see and our wrong apprehension about what might be possible and real in the universe? For our whole view and experience of existence labors under a limitation of consciousness which is not ours alone, but seems to be at the basis of the material creation. Instead of the original and ultimate consciousness, which sees reality as a whole, we see active here a limited consciousness and either a partial and unfinished creation or a cosmic kinesis that moves in a perpetual circle of meaningless change. Our consciousness sees a part and parts only of the manifestation, if manifestation it be, and treats it or them as if they were separate entities. All our illusions and errors arise from a limited separative awareness which creates unrealities or misconceives the real. Careful phrasing there. But the problem becomes still more enigmatic when we perceive that our material world seems to arise directly, not out of any original being and consciousness, but out of a state of inconscience and apparent non-existence. Our ignorance itself is something that has appeared as if with difficulty and struggle out of the inconscience. So in other words, we see not the origin, but the result of a restriction of conscious being. And we seem to rise from darkness, not light, seeing things from that restriction of conscious being. So what is that ignorance? This then is the mystery. How did an illimitable consciousness and force of integral being enter into this limitation and separativeness? How could this be possible? And if its possibility has to be admitted, what is its justification in the real and its significance? It is the mystery not of an original illusion, but of the origin of the ignorance and inconscience, and of the relations of knowledge and ignorance to the original consciousness, or superconscience. So, we are poised now to enter the next chapter, which really focuses upon this, and will, for more than just the next chapter, the knowledge and the ignorance. He has, along the way, dismissed the idea that the real can be an illusion. The real cannot subjectively manifest and illusory, unreal, and the real cannot manifest a separate unreality. All is part of the one. There is an omnipresent reality. So this ignorance, which conditions and limits our perspective of an evolving universe which manifests this absolute, has to be explained, but in the context of this omnipresence. So that will be his business in coming chapters. So tonight we turn again to Savitri, but a different section. Last week we finished the one long passage that we were reading from, and tonight we go into book two, the book of the Traveler of the Worlds. And we'll read from canto four. The Kingdoms of the Little Life. In the enigma of the darkened vasts, in the passion and self-loss of the infinite, when all was plunged in the negating void, non-being's night could never have been saved if being had not plunged into the dark, carrying with it its triple mystic cross. Invoking in world time the timeless truth, bliss changed to sorrow, knowledge made ignorant, God's force turned into a child's helplessness, can bring down heaven by their sacrifice. A contradiction founds the base of life. The eternal, the divine reality, has faced itself with its own contraries. Being became the void and conscious force, nescience and walk of a blind energy, and ecstasy took the figure of world pain. In a mysterious dispensation's law, a wisdom that prepares its far-off ends, planned so to start her slow eonic game. A blindfold search and wrestle and fumbling clasp of a half-seen nature and a hidden soul, a game of hide-and-seek in twilight rooms, a play of love and hate and fear and hope, continues in the nursery of mind its hard and heavy romp of self-born twins. At last, the struggling energy can emerge and meet the voiceless being in wider fields. Then can they see and speak, and breast to breast, in a larger consciousness, a clearer light, the two embrace and strive, and each know each, regarding closer now the playmate's face. Even in these formless coilings he could feel matter's response to an infant stir of soul. In nature he saw the mighty spirit concealed, watched the weak birth of a tremendous force, pursued the riddle of Godhead's tentative pace, heard the faint rhythms of a great unborn muse. Namaste. Jai Ma.